quarter of an inch over from the previous memory. And I mean, she's mapping every part of the ear and inside, outside, front, back, all of her father's stuff encoded around the ear nerve plexus. So understand, you can have 50, I'm sure we're going to get to find this, 50, 100 memories before the ear pain releases. Every time she did this, it felt better. And then we went to a few other memories and came back to the ear again afterwards. So as far as how memories map and they present for the client, this might be helpful for you. But my work from now, I'm booked till like November for 4-day intensives by families, usually two at a time, a couple or a family flying in, and the wives are saying, thank goodness he's never been able to get past this point in comfort and talking openly about his feelings, and now he can. And they'll talk about immediate results from the communication skills and the ability. So couples are flying. They're not generally doing it with each other in the room. They're doing it personal work. And so couples are doing it. As far as people being resistant to coming back, what Karen said is true. Probably the scariest thing about it is they realize this is not a very slow, tedious talk therapy. That what they'll do in one session, we've had clients say, what I just did with you in one session is the equivalent of what it took me 2 years of work with my talk therapist to do. And it freaks them out a little bit, and they're like, I'm not sure. And you can, I have a form I'm using now for processing memories. How has this memory affected my life? How has it affected my decision making? So I'll send that to Jeanette, and we'll send that to you. I've included it now in my handouts. Because after I print out all the sequencing of the memories in a session, they can take it home and they can walk through each memory with the processing questions. How does releasing this trauma pattern from my throat change my life and open me to new possibilities? And one is like, oh, now I can speak my truth more openly. I can have my voice. So the processing form I've actually broken down into detail, and they can do the processing questions with each memory that they reframe. And that can be quite helpful as well. There was something else I was going to say about that, and it popped out of my head. But the resistance issues can be extreme and varied as to where they come from. Erica was asking more specifically about that.
My experience, I've not had the really strong resistant part that I call the level 2.5, I did not have him show up until the second session.
That's interesting.
Yeah, first session looks clean, looks normal, and then second session, you realize there's another part that's really wanting to control everything. And another little tidbit that's not directly related to that last statement is, I will also, at the end of the first session, I always tell my clients now we've been working with the body and the memories in the body, and your body may have some other memories between now and the time we work again. And I use the example because it's a little bit silly and relaxing. I say, your big toe may start throbbing all of a sudden. And if it does, you just thank your big toe for the memory and let it know that we're going to work on it. Jot it down if you need to, journal if you need to. Otherwise, just thank it. And if you thank it and it goes away, we know that's a memory. And that's sometimes, at least when things come up, they are prepared to say, yep, my memories came up, just like you said. I'm feeling a little more confident in going forward with this work.
Very good. I use the 2-3 minute principle. If a new pain shows up different from what you already worked on, take 2 or 3 minutes, identify where you're feeling it, and talk to the part. If you can talk to the pain sensation, say, I know you're there. I have to go to work today. I have the kids to take care of. You can please give me a break, and I'll work on you as soon as I have opportunity to reframe. Or what I tell my clients is, tell them you're going to see Brent on Wednesday, and we're going to continue work with the parts of the memories as soon as we can. I invite them to the safe scene. You can invite them to kind of release some of the pain with a waterfall. There are a variety of things you can do to try to get immediate containment of the cyborg. What Karen said is true. If you talk, always end your session by saying, we thank all the parts that came up today. We thank the ones that might come up afterwards that are requiring attention. Let them know we'll honor them. We know they're there, and we will work on them as soon as we have opportunity, like in the next session. And hopefully have that scheduled. You can give them a time or date when you have that scheduled. That's always very helpful too. And yeah, so safety, some of you talked about people having, Karen had a case, that's Karen had a different case from Vietnam. I should forget your last name, Karen, all of a sudden. Okay. So, yes, can you hear me now, Karen?
Yes.
Yeah. So you had a case that you were talking about that was very interesting about energy, I think, shifting in her body.
This person became extremely tired, fatigued. She could barely, she was actually drifting off to sleep partway into, it was more the second half of the session. Mm-hmm. And I would really need to sort of keep prompting her to continue. She was trying to do her reframing, but she was just literally like head dropping, eyes closed.
Okay, let me pause you. Pause you for 1 second here. A couple of things about that. Number one is you may be hitting an anesthesia memory. So one of the things that comes up in the body first is if they start passing out, drugging, slumping, has she had any surgeries in recent years that you know of? Do you know of anything surgical?
No, C-section.
Did they do an epidural or anything of that sort?
Do you not know? That I recall.
You want to check on anesthesia, trauma, and the history. That's one possibility. The other is you can have a part that under extreme duress as a child was so depressed she went to sleep. If you're accessing that part that's triggering a series of memories or violations, or if the child pretended she was asleep during abuse or sexual abuse and actually checked out or disassociated, these are all possibilities that could be part of a more serious escape plan, so to speak, a survival plan. I would check first for any kind of drug experiences that she might have had, because it sounds like something in her sensation and that you're relaxing her with your voice and the technique could be triggering a previous anesthesia response. That is a real possibility. And if she starts to feel kind of sleepy or sluggish, it can trigger the memory of the anesthesia and they'll literally drop off to sleep in front of you. Now, some children also cope under abuse and trauma by going to sleep. And if that is a part, you're right, you have to bring her back and find out how young are you when you're using sleep or checking out or used a drug perhaps or a medication to numb out. These are all possibilities. It's kind of very broad as to which of these it might be at this point without more history from her. That's where I would go into history more closely and say, have you had any surgeries? Have you had this experience of falling off to sleep? I mean, you can have a narcoleptic. I've seen a couple of narcoleptic people over the years that just start falling asleep anytime, anywhere, and they actually have a diagnosis of narcolepsy. But as far as trying to trigger a memory and that being induced, I would check for medical traumas. They can have anesthesia side effects if they've ever been under anesthesia. Any circumstance similar to the thing that caused the anesthesia can cause them to go under and start to pass out. I have seen over the years many, many times when people are in a state of extreme PTSD, all I have to do is place my hand on C7. And it's like, oh my goodness, I've never felt safe with my PTSD. And within probably 120 seconds, you'll see their head start dropping. And they're gonna have trouble keeping their head up. They're gonna have trouble keeping their head lifted in order to be able to do the work. And I think, you know, even though they're wanting to do a session or were sent for a session, one of them I found was a woman who had, I think she was work exhausted, and I think she had been abusing alcohol, and I think her whole body was in a state of extreme exhaustion, and she wanted to do therapy. And so if they're burning themselves out and they're working so hard and they're tired when they come for the session, when you put your hand on C7 and for the first time they feel safe and they have a message, it's okay to relax, they'll almost pass out in the chair.
I think that actually could be it, because she was extremely tired. She has her own company. She did express being exhausted. So that
seems to resonate. Yeah, if you're trying to, because what HMR does is it creates an unusually intense but grounded state of relaxation for the subconscious to come up. But the conscious mind is supposed to rise to the occasion and provide the information. If, however, the conscious mind and the body is in a state of complete exhaustion, then when you add that extra safety and you say it's safe now, it's okay to relax, she's going to like curl up on your lap and go to sleep for 3 days to catch up on her exhaustion from work and say, wow, this is a great place. Can I just stay here for a few days until I recharge? And she'll never get off your table. But I don't know how much, how much reframing we're going to do. Our ability to do the reframing is relative to the client's energy levels. Like my client that did, I think like 15 memories yesterday, came in and was a little slower this morning. And she said, I also did 14 memories on my own last night when I finished. And she said, and she did another 14 this morning when I worked with her, at 15 this afternoon. And she's like lucid, clear. She's done all kinds of other therapies, but she says, I've never seen anything. This pulls together all of her previous therapies. She says, I've done hypnosis. I did body work. I did, you name it, she's done it. And she's part of a sort of a metaphysical spirituality group, which does meditations every week kind of a thing. And she's followed up with that. And she says, but I've never seen anything that allows me to step in and go straight to memory and reframe it and get the solution and go to the next memory. And so she's, and I feel every shift, every time she corrects, she goes through beautifully. But yeah, I think exhaustion. So we have to, like, you know, next time, see if you can get some rest before you come in for your session and have your, because otherwise, you know, they're in a state of collapse. I get that in Miraval sometimes. They come in and they look like they're ready, you know, for a Miraval rest, but they just arrived. And they're in a state of exhaustion. The first thing they did is build themselves in for a trauma session. And I'm like, you know, you just flew from New York City, you have jet lag, you were, you know, on a red eye, whatever it is, you didn't sleep well on the plane, and now you booked yourself for a trauma session first thing in the morning, and I'm like, you look like you're about to pass out, or you're very tired. So there is a question about, you know, when we introduce the technique to our clients, it would be nice to tell them to preferably come when they're rested, not medicated. You know, HMR isn't a substitute for abstinence from drugs. I have a woman this week I've been working on who was about to check herself into Sierra Tucson, the treatment center, but it wasn't for alcoholism issues. It was more for codependency issues. And when she saw the poor state of a lot of the treatment centers right now, she's like, I'm not doing that, but I heard about your work. So she came in, and at Miraval, we set up a program where she did the Equine experience with Wyatt in the morning. I set her up for the cranial sacral therapist who combines it with acupuncture and is excellent. So she started with the equine in the morning, went to cranial sacral and acupuncture in the afternoon, and completed with me later in the afternoon with HMR, and had just an excellent day. And she's done that for 3 days now, not the horses every day, but she's done the cranial and some other therapies. And in 3 days, said, I've done more here in 3 days, and they told me I could do 2 weeks inpatient with all the lecture series and everything they were going to put me through. So eventually, folks, we have to come together and design some treatment settings that allow us to do this work, along with maybe cranial sacral neurotherapy, mapping the memory sequences, looking at the brain and how they're changing as they reframe each session. And with the right instrumentation, we could set that up. We could do that. So stay tuned. In the next 3 years, we may be opening some HMR centers in different parts of the country. And if you're certified, you might be able to work with us there.
Well, with my sessions, I do the, because we talked about this when I did the course with you in September about how to incorporate the body cranial therapy. Yes. And your suggestion was to do sort of like a sandwich thing. But what I found works beautifully is to start with the HMR, and then to go to the table afterwards, and it's the biodynamic cranial sacral therapy. So it's very, very subtle. And I find that it's been a really great coupling because they continue to sort of process the memories of things that came up. They continue to run the colors through that they did in the reframing. It's been a really good sort of complement to the technique.
Perfect.
What I do want to say, though, also is that, so 8 years ago, my bread and butter, so to speak, was really deep tissue massage. Mm-hmm. And that's what people were coming to see me for. That's what my reputation grew on that. But then I don't know how anybody can do any kind of body work and not realize, oh, there's something more, or trying to get to the root cause. So for me, it's always been this quest of trying to get to the root cause, which led me to the cranial sacral therapy, which then led me to your work. So it's always trying to, you know, peel that back and get to what's really the issue. But you're right, people. So now people realize, like, whoa, what she's doing, even with the cranial sacral therapy, what I'm doing is getting to a deeper level of what, it's not just my shoulder. There's some sort of emotional link there. And they're afraid. Like, I see it. It's like numbers have dropped off. But it's this thing of, am I ready? And with this, the expat community here, there's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of other stuff that people are doing to sort of just kind of get by. They go from one party to the next party on each the weekends and that sort of thing. So there's not a lot of really internal work going on. Definitely not a lot of deep work. So you're definitely, what other people are saying here today is true, that it's, you've just got to be ready to come and do the work or not. Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, I think I've been seeing a lot of people that are coming in for first sessions, very first time I'm seeing them. So some follow up, some do not. What I have now the luxury of doing those for the next, well, from now on, probably. Half of my work is the brief therapies at Miraval, and half of it is going to be this intensive 5-day process. Some are staying through Friday, Saturday, or lengthening their stays. So I'm reducing a bit of my hours at Miraval to accommodate the potential for long-term 2 sessions a day. Many of them are doing 2 a day. They're doing 1.5 to 2 hour intensive sessions and doing a lot of work in a very short amount of time. And they're doing fine. If we need to break, take an afternoon nap, go for a hike. I give them 1 afternoon off in the middle of the process so they can, you know, do something with nature, go up Mount Lemmon, go to the desert museum, chill out, see a little bit of Tucson and relax. And we're in the hottest part of the year. We're over 100 degrees here sometimes. So you never perspire, but you know, they're perfectly fine, you know, finding ways to relax and chill out in between. And some of the, most of these that I'm working with are very, very highly motivated. So I'm very grateful, but there are some that have had an alcohol abuse issue. So I'm like, we'd like to reduce that. And my policy, of course, with addictions is if you're in active addiction, HMR is not going to substitute for abstinence from the drug you're dependent on. If you're chemically dependent, you still need to find a way to get off the drug of choice. But some people, if you don't resolve the pain triggers from the trauma memories, will have a lot more difficulty with a trigger mechanism in choosing to abstain. They'll have a lot more difficulty if they haven't resolved the pain source. So it depends how much of the pain is actually dependent on memory, how much of the memory can be resolved in a timely manner, and how addicted they are they to the medications to ease the pain. If it's too much medication, the HMR will not hold. We've talked about that with the benzodiazepines. But for the most part, I get people that are abusing some drugs, and most of them have already weaned themselves down, but have not maybe eliminated alcohol yet. But after we have the HMR sessions and talk about it and the consequences, then they're moving in the direction of eliminating it. For the most part, I'm dealing with mostly memory-based pain and not necessarily chemical dependency as much anymore. Anything else about that? I think there are many kinds of resistance. Talk about that. But the cranial sacral combination, when I don't have an HMR practitioner in the city someone has come from, I often say, can you see if there's a cranial sacral practitioner or an acupuncturist? And there are those that are, like in Miraval, Kari combines cranial sacral and acupuncture in the same process. She has a particular name for what she does, and it's a really nice combination. So when people are coming in, we're giving them acupuncture, cranial sacral, HMR, and sometimes equine-assisted psychotherapy. And one client, we did it all in one day. And that's unheard of, even inpatient, all that's broken up and it takes them weeks to get booking what we just did for this person that flew in. So that was very interesting that she was able to do that good work. Other questions and things about that or related, any other comments that you have?
I have a
yes.
Okay. Yeah. Two things that I do energy healing, so I often have clients going to really deep. When I do energy healing, they go to really deep relaxation. So even when we do this work, it tends to put people into like a deeper state, especially when learning the color after replacing.
Right.
That's one thing that I think maybe part of the energy healing component coming into play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then the other day, there's a woman who said that the hand behind the C7 irritates her.
Yeah, and it can. And I've had the same thing happen. Like, oh, actually, there were a couple of interesting clients. One of them jumped out of, actually, there was, anyway, this is a very bizarre case. There was a girl with a brain trauma, brain injury, who couldn't make eye contact. In fact, I've had two people. I had another man this week who also didn't look at me for 80%, 90% of the session, getting in the chair, who couldn't. And he's only 69 years old, and I'm like, he's acting like, I thought he was like 83, 82. He's walking and moving, and he has an eye disorder, which slows him down. But I think slowing down because of the eye disorder is causing a certain level of muscular atrophy, or he's becoming almost immobilized by the fact that he's moving so slowly. So he acts almost like an Alzheimer's patient and came in, and he wouldn't make very much eye contact, and his speech was slowed. So I'm thinking he has a diagnosis that they didn't identify and that they never told him about. But one of the girls, when I was working with her in the session, finally admitted that she had had a severe head trauma, and not just soft tissue damage, but actually brain damage. And I saw that she was not tracking properly. There was something very wrong with her tracking, and she couldn't make eye contact. And just so for boundaries, I put my hand on her back, and she says, "I think I'm picking up sexual abuse images from you." And I said, I forgot how I responded directly. I said, well, first of all, that's not going to be happening. That's not my reality that you would be seeing. And I said, I'm not sure if there's a fear coming up about that. You know, is there a particular memory or issue where you have that kind of fear of an intrusion? And I forgot exactly how I handled that one, but it worked out really well because I said, anything that you would ever be. I said, number one, I'm gay, first of all, so I'm not interested in you. I just told her. I said, I'm gay and I'm not interested in you sexually as an object. That's not part of my agenda here. So I just nipped that one in the bud. And I said, secondly, I don't know what you'd be seeing. I said, you know, that's never occurred in my experience with any clients. But if there's some type of, and I began to wonder if she was schizophrenic or if the brain damage was generating pseudo imagery of some sort, or if she was hallucinating. Because I said, schizophrenics will go into their greatest fear. And I said, this could be a schizophrenic reaction that she's having, and she's moved into a state of schizophrenia because she's like, you know, I think I'm seeing sexual images coming from you. And I'm like, well, that's not going to be happening. But I said, if there's anything you're uncomfortable with, I said, we can do this across the room. And as soon as I said, plus I'm gay and it's not interesting, her shoulders dropped and she calmed down and she relaxed. And I said, do you have any history of abuse or anything? Sorry. And then she went into the medical traumas and the brain damage and the head injury and the hospitalizations and medical traumas. And I think she literally has brain damage and is not tracking correctly. And her eye contact is completely off. And so I worked with her and just created safety. I think she worked on one or two little memories. And then she just stood up and said, can I end the session now? And it was about probably 15, 20 minutes from the end of the Miraval session. I said, sure. I said, you're not under any obligation. And then she stood up and she said, okay, I think we're going to end now. She says, but you know what? Thank you for the session. I enjoyed the color piece and found that very interesting and helpful. And I feel more grounded and I might do this again in the future. And then she walked out. She took off. And I'm like, she almost ran out of the room that way. But I was like, okay. She reached her saturation point. I identified the fact that there's brain damage and an entirely erratic, unpredictable processing. I knew there was something wrong. Obviously, there was a brain injury. Finally, three quarters into the session, he's like, and also, by the way, I had a brain trauma from an accident and was in a coma for 6 weeks, came out, and I had to learn to speak again and communicate, and my vision's been affected. And she went in, and she wouldn't tell me what all they diagnosed her with, and I didn't ask at that point. I said, well, thank you for sharing that part with me. That's what I was looking for when I asked her history, because she was obviously not moving normally and tracking normally. So there's always been a question, what's the limitation of the client you can do HMR with? So the youngest I've ever done it with is a 3.5-year-old leukemia patient who is the most articulate little boy I think I've ever come across, who completely tracked perfectly and made most adults I've ever seen jealous, probably, of how he tracked. It's in my stomach. It's like a soccer ball. It's really tight. It kind of hurts right now. What would you like to do with that? Kick it away? Let's do that. Can you picture children do quick color replacement or object replacement? What color would you replace it with? Cerulean blue. I was like, okay, you have crayons we didn't grow up with. Let's move your cerulean blue through your body. He did that. He was perfect. They brought in a 7-year-old girl who was from Cambodia, who was adopted and witnessed her parents killed by the Khmer Rouge. And her adopted mother wanted her to reframe that if possible. And she was almost nonverbal around strangers and strange people. She wouldn't talk, she wouldn't communicate. And her mother just held her the whole time. And I explained a little bit about the technique, but she wouldn't engage at all. And so we were not able, I said, maybe when she's older, she'd be willing to be able to remember and talk about it and benefit. But she was just way too traumatized to even be for a male to be proximate to her. So she could not do it. Individuals that have had severe head traumas and have damaged, an IQ of say 65 or 70. I was like, uh-oh, let's see how this goes. And they were like, yeah, it's a brick in my head. It's red, it's heavy. Can you see where you are? Yeah, I'm at work. What happens? They hit me with a brick. I was like, okay, we could change that. And they did it perfectly. It's like a child mind, simple, concrete, very visual. I had a 14-year-old girl, I think I mentioned this in a previous session, who I put my hand on C7, she's looking at her fingers, she looked at her fingernails the whole time, wouldn't make eye contact. I realized she didn't want to be there. She had worked with 8 previous therapists, didn't want to do a session. I said, you really don't want to be here, do you? She's like, no, not really. I said, why is that? I've worked with 8 previous therapists, and my mother wants me to be here. I said, you know, let me tell you what I do is different. I'm not doing any therapy on you. I'm giving you the chance to use some skills that I have to work on yourself. And then I started talking about the empathy. My mother was an empath. They get really interested in the weird stuff. My mother was an empath. She could feel when we were in accidents and injuries. I found a point near C7, and with your permission, I'll put a hand on your back. You'll feel deep. Have you done energy work? Oh, I've done acupuncture in the past. I did Reiki once. I was like, okay. Cool, Reiki and energy work. That's kind of what we're going to do. And I went to put my hand on C7, and her eyes were like, it wasn't just rapid eye movement. It was like this. It was violent. And I said, you witnessed something very aggressive. By the way, the degree of eye movement often reflects the degree of violence or agitation in the nervous system. So when you're seeing this, this person has witnessed probably a very violent act and is in a state of hyperstimulation visually. And so when I went to put my hand on C7, as I approached, it started as I touched C7, it went like this, and I bypassed the protocol. I said, it looks like you witnessed something very aggressive in the past, you know, few years. Do you know what this is? She nodded. I said, was this recent? And her mother had mentioned her brother started using drugs and did something. And so I had a few pieces of information to cue. And I said, do you know what this event is? She said, yes. I said, how old are you? She said, current age. Can you see where you are? And she's still doing this. She said, the living room, what's happening? My brother pulled a gun, he got high on drugs, pulled the gun and put it to my head. And I said, okay, if we could reframe that, change that, what would you see happen? Oh, he was nice when he got treatment sooner. Can you picture that? She reframed the memory. Picture that. As soon as she moved the color through, it went from this, slowed down and almost stopped, but then it started again. And I said, there's a second memory. She said, yes. I said, how much later? She said, a month later, he relapsed. What happens then? He puts his hand around my throat. raises me off my feet and pins me to the wall, and he's choking me. I'm like, okay, this is homicide. So by the way, homicide has very strong rapid eye movement. You know, I was like, okay, if we could reframe that, what would you see happen? I'd have him get treatment sooner and picture getting, not using drugs. And can you picture that? Yes, what color? She reframed it, moved it through her body. She was totally calm and she was fine. So you never know about the reactions. You know, those that have extreme, I saw she was in acute distress. I sped up the language process. You can bypass it. You know, the purpose of the language was to get people into trance. So if they're evidencing the trance from the degree of rapid eye movement, or they're starting to shake and tremble, they're in the trance state. You might want to make sure they're at T-1. Like, do we need to go any further? I just say, do we need to go any, you know, they're shaking. Do we need to go any further into this? No, 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 no. If we could change it, what would you see happen? And I bypass the protocol, forget, get them to the safe place. Frame it and run the colors through the body. So if for some reason they're demonstrating the affect and showing it and they're about to collapse in the chair, do not continue the deepening process with the questions. Go to solution immediately. Let's move your, and you can say, move your safe color through your body, remember your safe color. Is it okay if I place a second hand on your shoulder next to you to know you're here with me? I'll increase physical contact with permission. Say, to know that your body is safe here with me, this is a memory. And your most of you remember the protocol for if they're sliding, if they're regressing in, move yourself into your adult. You're safe here with me. Your six-year-old self is trying to show you an abuse memory. Are you okay continuing? And ask permission to continue. Then let's run your safe color through your body. I've even had them say, look me in the eyes, make eye contact with me. You're aware that you're in my office and you're here with me. Are you okay continuing with this memory? Do you want to know what happened? Yes, okay, then run your safe colors through your body. Is it okay to leave the second hand on your shoulder? Yes, no, whatever. Okay, let's continue. What happens next? And then do we need to go any further? I sometimes in a new memory will walk them past T-1. And the reason is if you're sure they're grounded and safe with you and they want to know a new memory what happened, they can walk through the entire sequence until it blurs. When it blurs, adrenaline kicked in, they're not probably going to recover the rest of it. But up to the point where the memory blurs or becomes a non-specific in detail, they're still in active memory recording. If you can identify the moment when, like, okay, now you know what happened, what would you like to do? I'd like to get out of here before he touches me. Let's back this up and take you out. Can you picture that? Yes. What color frame do we put around the corrected image? And so using the sliding piece, if they start to regress too far, how does the adult you feel about him doing that to your five-year-old self? It's not any longer. And what happens next when you're five and you're in a dark room? That's if you're trying to find the child. If the child is actually taking over the body, you speak to the observer, to the adult. How does the adult you feel about him doing that to you when you're five? And one of the clients said, I don't know, I still live with him. I'm still terrified of him. It's like, okay. Yeah, she's like still shaking. I'm like, do you have a niece or a nephew that age? She said, yes. How would you feel about him doing that to your niece? She's like, she stepped back. She said, I'd want to kill him. I was like, there you go. We have your angry adult self. You stepped into the observer. I'd like for you to bring that wise adult self to protect your inner child. What would you like to do? Oh, I'd like to knock him out and remove her. Let's remove her from the scene. And once you had her step back far enough to tap into the angry adult self, that's a technique that Virginia Satir and that they used a lot with empty chair gestalt work. If the client cannot access the anger, have them step farther back from the perpetrator. Move away from the scene. With HMR, we're moving back from the scene itself and say, step back a bit. You're the observer, you're here with me. How do you feel about him doing that to your five-year-old self? And at that point, the anger comes in. There'll still be a little, they might say, I just want to remove her, take her to the safe place. Good, and if we need to do another reframe of your anger in later or in a future session, we can do that as well. Often once they're not in fear, you'll get a return of the image or the memory with the unresolved anger piece. So often there's two sides to the coin. I want to just get, if they're too scared and codependent, I want to get her out of there. Then once they're out of there and they're safe, like, I'm really ticked off at him. I'd like to shoot and blow him off. Okay, let's do the anger piece, part two. Because you can use two solutions for the same memory. One, I don't want it to happen. One, I'd like to, you know, protect or shoot him or blow him up or have somebody protect me if it did happen. I would like mom to believe me when I told her it happened. So it's very common. I often, with a lot of memories, you'll do double solutions. One, I had this week, I had somebody, I want it to not happen. I said, do you want it to not happen or have your mother believe you when you tell her about it? I want both. I want one, it doesn't happen so my body knows what health looks like. And the second part is I'd like to see my mother respond and be willing to protect me and know that I'm nurtured and safe. Can you picture that? Yes, let's do both. And they're different colors. There'll be different color frequencies for the two different solutions. They're different energies. You might even say they're the same color, but they're not the same image. Therefore, scientifically, they're not the same frequencies, you know? They're not transmitting the same image. We use yellow, blue, green. That's like completely non-specific. But the colors you see for each memory you reframe are entirely unique in the universe. They're entirely unique in the order of perception. The movie you're creating, me of right now, has never been an image ever seen by you before. The seven colors combining to create this movie are unique to your perception. Therefore, the colors you insert into your history are unique as solutions for your body. Okay, anyway, that's a little bit about just solutions and colors and about getting out sooner, sliding. Resistance, sometimes it's about going into what's the feeling coming up. Guilt, anger. I've had a lot of clients interrupting their memories with sub-memory routines this week. Oh, I feel shame about that. I don't think I'm worthy of having, too stupid to have feelings. Like, whose voice is that? Oh, that's my mother. Okay, let's go into the sub-memory routine. Excuse me. We can't do your father, we can't finish your father memories because your mother just interrupted and said you're too stupid to even be emotional and have a feeling. How old are you when you feel that? If we could pile up all the messages from mother where she abused you verbally and said you were stupid, I can't see mother anymore. It's taller than she is. What do you want to do with that? And there are a couple of solutions I introduced over the past year. What would you like to do with all that abuse? I'm not sure. Would you like to send it through her as an empathy wave? Oh, what happens then? Oh, wow, now she understands what she's been putting me through and she looks sad and she stops doing it. Sometimes the narcissist, they don't really care. Okay, let's hand it to her higher self. Let's turn her over to divine law enforcement. That's a favorite. Okay. Are the karma angels, understand if you can ask the question, it's an angel for every occasion. But as far as being able to come up with new solutions, some memories, remember to back up to the originating memory and check to make sure you've reframed the one that it spun off of. And you can have level two sub-memories and you can have level one sub-memories, individual reframes. Okay? Other questions, comments?
Cases? Yes, with that process that you were just talking about, when you do the level two group healing and also some individual traumas can also be processed if they're triggered at that time. Can you talk about how much does the actual group healing when you accumulate many traumas together and process it? I've done it a number of times, and the clients that I've worked with are almost all level three clients. I worked 7 years at a residential treatment center for female drug addicts. And, mm-hmm. and most of them are level three. And in many cases for the major traumas, they have many, you know, many rapes or many domestic violences or whatever.
Okay. Hang on one second. Let me ask you a question. The way you're using level three is probably a little bit off. Level three is multiple personalities, psychosis, split personalities, apparently individual normal parts that don't know each other's existence. Most people are level one and two, and drug addicts typically stop at level two or level two and a half because they numbed out and medicated. Therefore, they didn't fragment. A level three person is a person that has fragmented within their psyche, either in psychosis or are multiple personalities. Are you saying that you work with a lot of multiple personalities?
No, I've labeled that wrong. I'm actually studying I'm doing your level three online right now. Okay. So let's
talk about that for a moment. So the good news is level one and two are 98% of the clients you'll ever deal with. So just so you're more comfortable with that, is the majority of people you'll ever deal with and all of their memories, maybe even more than, well, eating disorders is a little challenging, but most of the people you'll deal with are going to be level ones and twos. Now, what you're asking, though, is the extent of the level two pattern and what that looks like. And so people with multiple rapes and multiple perpetrators, you're right. It's very complex. It's going to be very intricate. And quite honestly, I don't think there's a technique out on the market that's going to have the ability to deal with the complexity you're going to face with some of these people. When I work with addicts, I know exactly why I developed this with addicts and why that I became an addictions counselor. They numbed out at level two by doing drugs and alcohol, which prevented them from getting to level three. So level, they didn't have to fragment into separate personalities before the age of five. They just numbed out and developed very strong sub-personalities and addictive parts and critical parts and the wounded. So have you read Dick Schwartz's work, also Internal Family Systems Therapy?
No, but I have read several other books on fragmented selves and multiple personality.
Okay, good. So, but this is basically parts work. So what you're dealing with is every part, remember, is a construct of a series of memories, level ones and twos. I'm still fascinated. I'm grateful. If you're not using the software, you may want to really think about this, because the software allows you to very simply track very complex patterns and monitor it as you're doing the process. Jeanette and I are going to be working on getting the trainees version of the software ready for you shortly. That's my next, I'd like to see that as our next goal, to get it operational. But in the meanwhile, the level two and for addicts, it's a form of the serenity prayer. What can we not change? What can we change that's left? It's an energy discernment process with three parts. You know, it has A, identify the affect or the issue. It can also be like a series of like sexual abuse to rape. You could actually do a specific level two targeting, you know, the ages and parts yourself where you were raped. Level B would be line up all the perpetrators. If it's a matter of safety and they're regressing as they're talking about the rapes, you'd go to safety. And want to make sure that any parts, any kind of severe sexual abuse, you probably want to start with safety. We can invite all the ages and parts of yourself that were ever seriously abused and made to feel. Now, if it's child parts, especially, and made to feel unsafe, you really need the enhanced safe scene. You really need a very detailed. And I'm spending more time with that, like take all the time you need. Tell me about your safe house. And between now and the next session, I want you to really flesh out and develop your safe house. What do the rooms look like? What are the colors? What are they painted? What are the things inside your house? What you're doing is getting them to do a Tibetan meditation technique about focusing on positive meditative detail to imprint in the subconscious. And when you do that and have them visualize colors or enhance their safe scene, put in guard dogs, put drones flying around. I mean, they do all kinds of creative things to enhance their safe scene. They're reinforcing safety, and it will be there in the next session. Now, I'm not sure I've gotten around exactly to your question, partly because the descriptor you're giving me for level two is kind of hard. I use it for so many things. I'll use it for an issue, like if it's a rape, like if you're working with a pattern, like multiple rapes. If we can invite all the parts of you that were raped to go to the safe scene, how many are there? That would give you an idea as to how many times it happened, at least the ones they remember, and how extensive the work might be. You can say, okay, if they can line up their perpetrators at a safe distance, who all is in the lineup? Is this one person abusing them throughout their childhood? Is this uncles, aunt, uncles, cousins, relatives? You get a lot of that. I got a client this week. Yeah, my cousins did it. My uncle did it. The neighbor, my dad's best friend, whatever, babysitted and molested us. So line up all the perpetrators. Now, if you could pile up all the shame from that, how big a pile is that? How would you like to return that to them? And I have clients, the entire session is level twos. A lot of my clients are just all level two. Some of them didn't have single individual traumas. They're patterns of abuse. But in many cases, and I had a client this week who was kind of confused about that because she started level twos, level two, level two, level two. And then she had a memory level one while she had a flashback while after the session. And she's like, but my pain came back. I said, let's find out what that is. We went to the memory, it was a level one. I said, we forget to tell you as the therapist sometimes that just because you've done the level two reframing doesn't mean that you will not access surprising, shocking individual memories that will still come up for you that need to be reframed. Once you've made the majority of the group safe and you have a consensus of safety, it's very common, however, to have a smell, a sound, a television, everything's on TV, it's reality TV. Everything is out there in the media now. If they see an image similar to their abusive man or a car, a truck, a vehicle, a piece of clothing similar to the perpetrator, they could easily go back into the memory. And once that memory has been triggered, you're going to have to move into that, immediately reframe that. There was something else I was going towards about that. I just lost my train of thought here. But anyway, the client will bring you back. That's the other thing. If you get lost in the process, the client's body will always take you back to where you stopped. So you can always go back to the client's body. But is there anything you'd like to say about the level twos? You have addicts.
Yeah, so
your addicts are ones and twos. So, combinations of ones and twos.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I made a mistake calling it level three. But when the group of level two traumas are processed at the same time, my experience is that it doesn't 100% clear out all of those traumas. It takes the edge off. It takes a big right. edge off it, and it clears them to a certain degree. But there's still individuals that are very significant. The individual traumas that will pop up as the body wants to bring them up in its own time.
Correct. Doing the level two reduces the larger body of overwhelm so that then the body will begin either doing smaller level twos or it will begin mapping the sequence of the level ones that created the parts and created the situations. So you're exactly right.
Right.
So we actually, you know, in a true body-centered, strictly body-centered therapy, you would wait for the client to bring it up as level two. But after I see a client repeating the same memory once, same memory twice, same abuse memory two or three times, I believe that the subconscious is implying the presence of a substantial level two, and I introduce it deliberately. So I'm like, okay, if you know, there's a rape memory and a rape memory and a rape memory. And I'm like, okay, if we could bring all your sexually abused selves to the safe place, how many are there? Well, there are 43 of them. I'm like, okay. If we could send them colors, talk to them, let them know they're safe, enhance safety. Let's do a little level two on that. Let's pile up all the accumulated shame. And then you're right. If you go back to the body, then they're like, oh, okay, so a bunch of parts of me are safe now. Now I can move into the individual memory. So you're quite right. The next one that comes up is probably a level one memory or a single scene that needs reframing. That's exactly how the technique works.
Yeah, and that does clear it up, because that's what I've experienced. Is I didn't believe that I was clearing every single trauma that ever happened to that client by doing a level two clearing, but that it was doing something for the belief system, and the body was relaxing, so that it made the other ones more accessible and easier to address. And it lowered the energetic charge to make it more easy to process it without any kind of abreaction coming up.
Correct. When I was in my early naive days, I'm like, oh, look, we've done shame. Oh, look, we've done anger. They've released their anger. Now, that's what, as Gestalt therapists, that's what we thought we were doing in the 70s and 80s. Like, oh, let's put them in the chair. Let's release all the shame back to daddy. Okay, you killed the chair, you bruised your hand, you murdered the bataka, the bat. They all died. And then afterwards, you found out there were a couple of memories you didn't quite get to reframe completely. And like, oh no, we didn't release all the anger. Then, okay, is that Jeanette? Who's the squealing dog person? Okay, one thing we discovered was that you can have anger and shame. You can have anger buckled with sadness. Anger with disappointment, anger with physical pain, anger with frustration. I mean, you got combinations of anger in different situations with different combinations of people. You have unlimited anger reframes, level two anger reframes. It's every, you know, there can be a variety of levels. Jeanette, are you with us? Okay. So I think she blocked whoever that was, whatever the noise was that was coming up, because that's going to be recorded as well.
Brent, Jeanette's not, she got lost her power, so she's not with us right now.
Oh, okay. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, whoever the dog person was, thanks for muting whatever that sound was in the background. You're good. We love our little animal unconditional loving support systems, but sometimes they can create a bit of a distraction. So cruelty to animals, by the way, watch that, because you're probably dealing with a psychopath. When they torture and hurt animals, I had a client this week, one of her father's favorite things to get to her was to abuse animals in front of her and harm the animals. So when you're dealing with that, you're dealing with somebody who is a psychopath in all likelihood, and has or sociopath and has no conscience. Anyway, other questions, issues, things going on? Yes. We've solved the world's problems. We're all good. Yes. Other questions?
Can you hear Beth?
Yeah, sure, Beth. We can hear you.
So I've got a question, because I'm still kind of a newbie, only doing this for a couple of months. When somebody, typically all I've done so far is when somebody does have an ache or a pain or they're triggered by some point of their body, where I start with a level one. If somebody comes to me, you know, you mentioned when we started, you know, the death of a grandmother, you know, if somebody comes to me and they're grieving, it would be obvious to do a level two on that. But do you ever backtrack and try to find out where they feel that in their body and take it back to a level one to perhaps lessen, you know, the intensity of their grief?
Well, you're asking a couple of questions. And as you get more comfortable with the language, you'll probably phrase it a little bit differently over time. But a death can be a level one or a level two. So the death of a person that is like getting sick for a long time, I'm so sad because I didn't get to say goodbye. They didn't call me until the last minute and tell me she was sick. I didn't get to say goodbye. That's a level one reframe about grief. If they were in pain when they died, I'd like to see her die without pain. That can be a level one or a level two. So I may ask, how long was she in pain? Oh my God, for 5 years. Were you a primary caregiver? Yes. You have a level two trauma related to how she passed. So you're going to need to do a level two. So what I do is picture with the pain things. I'm like, can you invite grandmother to be here with us? Yes. Can you picture grandmother? Yes. Can you picture holding a shoebox out in front of her? Yes. I want you to put all the videos and DVDs of all the pain moments and all the pain sequence in the shoebox, because the minute she left her body, she's free of the pain. The only person now maintaining the pain and the pain memories is you. Can you see what she'd like you to do with all the pain memories? Oh, she's holding out the box. She wants me to put them in the shoebox. Can you see what she does with them once we put them in the shoebox? Yeah, she's throwing them over her shoulder. She's burying them in the garden. We used to play in the garden all the time. She's picking a hold and burying them. She's putting them. She's burning them up. She's just throwing them away. She's putting them in the trash. So let's get rid of the level two. Now, so you're going to have to feel your way through deaths and losses. Is it a level one?
It's okay.
And I was just using that as an example. It was more about somebody coming in with the emotion. Because
now, here's the thing.
We take the pain and we try to get to the emotion. But I guess my point was, when they're coming in just with the emotion, am I then trying to help them identify where they might be feeling that in their body? I was just using that as
you can go with the feeling. You can do a feel, and you want to know it's a level one or a level two. When you feel sad, where do you feel that in your body? If it's sadness about grandma dying, my heart. Now, when you ask, how old are you when you first feel sadness about your grandma's death? If you ask how young might you be when you first feel the sadness, you might go, oh, that's grandpa's death 13 years prior when he dropped dead of a heart attack.
Right.
What you'll get is the prehistory that led up to why this loss is so significant.
Exactly. That's kind of what I was
thinking. There's a whole discussion though, that comes up about, is the client fragile and that you only want to target the one memory? If the client, some therapists believe their client is fragile and can only do the one memory, then you say, when you think about your grandmother's death, where do you feel that in your body? Can you see where you are when grandmother died last week and you're feeling all this sadness about her death? So what you're going to do is go for location. It's probably a level one memory and you're targeting the current event. Right. If you're targeting a specific memory, you already know the age. You know what happened last week probably. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to ask age. So what are you going to go for? Can you see where you are when you feel so sad about your grandmother dying? Yeah, I'm getting a phone call and there's nobody there with me. Well, if we could change that, I'd like to have my father there tell me in person and give me a hug. Sometimes it's how they got the information.
Hey, you want some?
And that's the trauma. Sometimes it's...
There's a bunch of them in the bathroom.
Yeah. So it could be how they got the information. It could be... So it could be a level one. It could be a level two. Now, a lot of people, the degree of grief is preceded by an entire history of losses. And so... And that's true for pain in the body. The pain you're experiencing could have, people have a little whiplash event and the whole body goes into fibromyalgia and collapse. How young are you when you first feel this pain in your shoulders? Oh my God, I'm 6 and I was in a bad car accident. Okay, this is not about your current car accident, recent accident. This is how young are you? So pain will do that. Any emotion, any, here's this is important. Any holographic experience, an emotion, a theme, a pattern, a feeling, a sensation in the body. If you ask, how young am I when I first feel this holographic icon of pain, you may get an entire session worth of memories, or several sessions, I think, sometimes, of a history that led up to it. When you feel like you're drinking alcohol, how old are you when you feel that? Oh my God, I don't think my first drink was that way, but now when I think about it, I would have to go back to my first drink and say that every time I started drinking when I was young contributed to the buildup of my shame about addiction. I didn't realize that. So my entire drinking history, all the ages of drinking, feel shame about that. Now it's a level two. And it's a retroactive memory because the first beer wasn't a trauma, but it is now. That's why the subconscious is better than historical. Sometimes it's trans-historical. What wasn't a trauma when it actually happened becomes associated with a pain event and a trauma later in life. And so it actually is, addictions are often a retroactive trauma that you build pain into the addiction sequence, which demands that you go all the way back to the originating use to reframe the pattern. I need to not take the first drink. I need to warn myself. If you can get that part to cooperate with you, your recovery is going to be a lot easier, because your addict self just went into recovery and is cooperating. But that can be a level two. Anyway, I'm getting around. But yeah, so if somebody comes in, like I say, I have a headache today. Oh, let's see if that's a memory. You know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just have so much sadness lately. Who feels sad? Where do you feel that in your body? The first question you're always going to go to for anything, the known event or unknown event or an amorphous feeling, is where do you feel that in your body? We always start somatically. And then it's going to, you know, you have the perfect language, you know, where did my body, inside, outside, or both, shape, size, color, weight, temperature, texture, anything else? I've asked that series of questions 150,000 times. That's at least how many memories I've already done. So prepare yourself. But when you ask how young are you or how old are you when you first feel this, that's going to then define, you know, whether it's a single event. Even with grief, it's like, no, this is not the first time I've been. I had a guy who was going home and he was doing it for the future. I feel anxiety about leaving. I have to go home and I have to drive past the bar every day. I'm like, oh, we can do this for the future. When you feel that anxiety about driving past your bar, where do you feel that? My chest, inside or outside? Both. What's it like? A tightness. How young might you be when you feel a tightness in your chest and have to go home or deal with alcohol or recovery? It's like, I've never felt this before. This is the first time I've ever felt it. I was like, oh, so this is for a future event. I said, okay, so if you could go home and picture it the way you'd like to see it, what would you see happen? I drive past the bar every day. I'd stay sober. I do 90 meetings in 90 days. Can you picture that? Yes. What color frame do you see? Oh, I see magenta. All right. He said actually yellowing. I remember he was yellow. Let's move yellow and green through your body. And what happens then? So I saw him months later and a year later, and he drives past the bar every day and never had a problem with it. And it was a future event. It wasn't a past event. So if you use a questioning sequence, but it was an anxiety that was coming up because he was leaving the treatment center. So your question, Beth, was, can you do a current event? Yeah, he was leaving treatment that day or the next day. And so I said, when you think about leaving, how do you feel? I'm anxious. Where do you feel that in your body? My chest. How old are you when you feel this anxiety? Oh, I've never felt this before. This is a new thing about having to drive past the bar. So let's picture that. And he did it and he was fine and he used that. So you can use it for a current event. I don't know if that answers all of your questions about focus.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It was just more just starting with an emotion versus a pain. So then I go back to
my a lot of people will come in like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just feel anxious this week. Well, let's see what that's about. I feel anxious. Right. Oh, I just feel so sad. I feel so tired. Sometimes I do tired. And sometimes I think I'm just exhausted. I'm too tired to work today. When you feel tired, where do you feel that in your body? My stomach, my chest, my arms. How old are you? Oh, my whole life, I think I felt tired like this. It actually might be a symptom of depression, but you can see. But it'll track, it'll come up for you.
I did have somebody go back to the womb a couple of weeks ago, and that was kind of exciting. That floating is. Around, and it was beautiful, and then she realized how lonely she felt, which has been a theme. She's about 58 years old, of just being abandoned and not feeling important. And the parents were always doing charity work, and she'd sit like a little dog by the door waiting for people to come home. And it's been a theme her whole life. And she went back to the womb where she realized how isolated and lonely she felt. It was actually quite powerful. She spoke to herself through her belly button and gave her self-confidence. So it was beautiful.
Excellent. I had a client this week, same thing, womb memory. Apparently when she was born, when she was in the womb, I guess mother, I don't know if it's the fluid in the womb is not very abundant, but she was born with her knee in the wrong position and her hand against her head the whole time. So she had a black and blue bruise, and they took a picture of her and used to tell jokes about it as it's about her childhood, you know, saying, look how colorful she was as a baby. And I'm like, she's like, you know, I couldn't get out. My hand was trapped against my head. So she actually had, her memory was of headaches and having head pain later in life. And I'm like, how old are you when you first feel this? She says, I'm in the womb. My hand's bounded next to my head and they're just, something else was going on with her mother, you know? So I'm not quite sure what that exactly what it was all about, but she reframed it in her headache. Her hand was on her head in the womb and trapped. She couldn't move it, it stuck, literally. So I'd never seen that before. So you never know what's going to happen in the womb. But they have memories. We'll go back. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? We have about 10 minutes left.
Yes. You talked about the client with a brain injury earlier today. Mm-hmm. I've had a few clients that either got in severe car accidents or severe domestic violence that had brain injuries. How do you assess for the safety of processing severe traumas with a client with brain injury? Do you ever get concerned that they may kind of lose their, you know, like if the brain isn't functioning right and if you activate that much emotion, do you ever have a concern that the brain may act or they may act in an unpredictable fashion because the brain is not functioning at its proper level? And I have worked with a brain injured. I just go much slower, but you know, much more cautiously, just to assess how they react when they process very lower level traumas. But How do you approach that? How do you assess? And do you back off at times if you somehow determine that the brain injury is going to cause some kind of bypass in the circuits when their body and mind react to the intensity of a higher level trauma?
Well, because the HMR is a body centered, client centered therapy, generally they're only going in to the extent that they're safe enough to be able to go in, because it's not depth hypnosis. So first of all, if the neural pathways are so disrupted they can't access, you're not going to be doing HMR because they can't track. Now, the girl that went into the weird tracking and processing and then disrupted it with a weird fear, terror, molestation, accusation, thought or something, I figured that out early on, and I was about to end the session prematurely when she ended it prematurely. But I was going to go as, I would probably say, start with safety and fully test visualization. See if they have color access. People with very damaged brains, the earliest languages for safety as a child are not words and not verbal processing. Your earliest language as a child was color, which is why I chose it as the primary safety language. Even people with severe brain damage often can see colors or visualize colors. So I would say and I can't answer that because I haven't worked with mostly the brain damage, you know. I work mostly with Republicans. I'm just teasing you. I'm kidding. That's a joke. Anyway, I'm working at Vera Wall with a lot of very affluent people. I'm not sure the states of their brains at all, you know. One thing that I would say is you want to test the visual and verbal skills capacity of the individual. Now, I've had people with severe brain damage and head injuries, and if they come out testing like a 65, 70 IQ, something like that, but they're concrete thinkers, little children, it's a rock, it's in my tummy, it hurts. What'd you like to do with it? Throw it in the yard, take all the time you need to do that. I don't think the success of HMR is based on IQ. I think it's going to be based on other levels of processing. If those parts of the brain that control processing are damaged, you're not going to be able to track the question. HMR is a very logical questioning sequence. If they're nonverbal, it's not going to work. We're asking questions. This is almost like energetic homeopathy, in that we're tracking to a specific moment in space and time where something is missing, and we're defining and putting in a very specific set of missing frequencies to get closure to what's a delusion, because the trauma is not really happening. It's the neurological system maintaining it that thinks it's still happening. So we're really trying to get neurological closure to an event that the body's maintaining that doesn't really any longer exist. So in a way, we're just trying to get closure to something that is a delusion. It's not really there anymore, except in the neurology of the body, in the 95%, which is nonlinear, the memory still exists intact. So if they can do that and process that, it's not a huge deal. We're not changing their history. We're not putting them in harm's way. Now, if something were to happen, they would start reliving the symptoms of the trauma. The whole hallmark of HMR is if they go in under their own steam, using their own colors, using their own safety, using their own language, you're not really there doing very much. If HMR is at its best, you're not like, can you tell me how young you might be? No, 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 you're not following HMR. You just inserted yourself between your client's conscious and subconscious mind. HMR was designed as the least intrusive, verbally effective method of using language to access a memory without triggering the memory or creating an abreactive response. Now, if there's some forms of brain damage that would disrupt that process, I don't have knowledge of that because I haven't worked with enough brain damaged individuals to tell you what the disruption would even be. Now, with people with autism, if they're nonverbal, I can't do it. Although I ran energy into a lovely young man who was autistic, and his mother said she never saw him stop trembling and stop moving around the way he calmed down. And so he was obviously able to hear something in process. We just had no way of getting the feedback from him at that time as to what he was hearing, seeing, or experiencing. But he came down, went down, and he said, she said, I've never seen him become still. So he got to benefit from just the hand on C7 and be still for a while and feeling his nervous system calm down. That's where body work, acupuncture, cranial sacral might be really nice body work for them. But I didn't have any feedback sources for him to be able to do the nonverbal part. And so, but I think you're going to just have to work with that and see how it comes out. For the most part, I would say test the functionality. Like she could pick, I said, well, you know, in level 3, I talk about psychotic patients. And that if they say they're seeing things and demons are chasing them, and I'm like, okay, they're not in reality. We could get any hallucination showing up when we ask a question, and therefore they're not able to reframe. They are completely ungrounded. And so a woman that was said she was hearing God and demons and angels all talking to her at the same time, I created safety to see if she could do it. She could create safety. She moved the color through her body. When I scanned her, there was no evidence of any violence anywhere in her system, not even being slapped or hit. And she's claiming all this violent imagery is coming up. And so her descriptors of her visual violent imagery were completely inconsistent with the somatic response. She was disconnected from her body. And therefore, if she had no evidence, somatic evidence, that any such memory ever occurred, we don't do HMR. They might say, look, I'm being hit by a truck, I'm being beaten by somebody. If they're not moving, breathing is not changing, your client is probably psychotic and they're not actually visualizing that. Now, if they're lucid, clear, describe changes, energy changes, color changes, to the best of my knowledge, then they're workable. HMR can function. If you're not sure, you give them the benefit of the doubt. But you want to look for indicators to make sure their reality testing is intact. I would say you would not proceed with a client in any state of brain damage if their reality testing and their ability to track, perceive color, or respond to linguistic cues is seriously compromised. You could do all, they could do body techniques, they could do acupuncture, they could do cranial sacral to release it from a somatic place, but HMR is dependent upon accurate verbal cueing in order to respond back. So that might be more information than you asked for about that. But I would say that's really what I would do in terms of determining what reality testing. I find very interesting to work with people with brain damage. I want to work with a lot of vets that have head injuries and see what we can do and how much they can see and how far they can go with the reframing if we can stop the flashbacks. Because color, we use color a lot. And color is your first language as a little child for safety outside the womb. And it's an infinite language. And the colors you see, if we can ask the questions, color is an infinite language. The colors you're seeing right now for your memories have never been seen before and are not my colors. This is not a color therapy. This is adapting the language of brainwave frequency using the dominant senses to transmit complex proof of safety to a part of the mind that froze in a moment in space and time when it didn't have safety. And so this is really brainwave frequency reinsertion, if you want to call it, for purposes of restoring flow of energy and consciousness in order to stop the flashback mechanism. If we don't stop the limbic reaction to the trauma, they're going to keep reliving the same pain cycle. And some people, there's that one case, you all know my case from the car accident. Apparently from the day her legs were crushed in the car accident, her body never stopped reliving the pain, the neurological pain cycle. Never, not for a moment. Until 37 years later when I reframed it and we moved green and gold through her body and her body stopped reliving the continuous pain cycle. Once a trance begins, there is no guarantee that it's ever going to stop. But if you can move safety through the body and prove you can create safety and stop the trance mechanism, then if it's memory-based pain, the portion that is memory-based goes away. If there's actual nerve damage or people ask about calcification and spots by, there's little calcifications, there's a name for that. There's little tumors that are just fatty tumors that are not life-threatening. Lipoids or something, lipomes. If it's not life-threatening and we don't, if it's not memory-based, HMR doesn't have an impact. However, some viruses seem to be, viruses may be memories. Viruses may be memories. And there is a possibility, that's how I started this work, is healing warts. I did warts today for clients, warts on somebody today. They were still doing the wart piece, but viruses or memories taking over the cell and seizing control of the cells of your body. It might be done holographically. I don't know. We might be getting into a whole new turf here. Holographic virus solutions, you know. So, but they replicate and they take over the cell. That is a kind of a holographic property. The fragment accesses the whole thing. So I don't know about that. If it's memory-based, holographic, or viral-related, HMR has a proportionate influence. If it's not memory-based, I don't know if it can affect very much. But understand, with medical trauma, the future of medicine is the little child going through chemotherapy for their brain tumor is going to be have somebody doing HMR with them as they go through the process, because they're very vulnerable and they're getting scared and their fear is encoding some of the pain during the chemo. It's not from the chemo. It's the anxiety state accompanying the chemo. And they're going to eventually be seen as incompetent. Cancer treatment centers that turned us away initially. Eventually, they're going to be seen as unethical if they're not doing these kinds of techniques accompanying the medical procedures. Because the way the procedures occur to a little child can be very traumatizing, just the pain of the needle. In fact, I have a theory that some of the autistic responses aren't from the vaccinations. It's from a small steel object being inserted into some of the most energetically sensitive people on the planet. And when you insert a stabbing metallic object into the skin of an individual who's hyper energetically sensitive, they feel like they're being violated like a rape energetically, and they're being traumatized and they disconnect. It's not the vaccination itself. It's the small steel needle being inserted under the skin that's creating like an anesthesia reaction, a trauma reaction. They might have made a mistake. Viruses can certainly have an effect on the system, but it may not be the vaccination. It might be the needle that was used to give the vaccine. Anyway, that's one of my theories about autism induction, that they might have missed the real source. I hated shots as a child, and I'm from a family along the autism spectrum. So we don't do intrusive metallic objects into our bodies. That is not a pleasant moment. They had to race around the doctor's office and try to catch me, and I ran track. It was hard for them to catch me with shots. You know, so anyway, but yeah, so that's a little bit about that piece of it. Other questions? I ran off track again. Something else.
One quick question. This shouldn't be very extensive. When clients say that they want to use black or gray, I think I read in one of your, or I either saw it in one of your trainings or one of your books, that you ask them to shine white light on it, and it usually turns to silver. Is that something that you said, or did I read that or hear it in a different place?
I probably did that at some point, but here's the story. People that are deaf, blind, and losing their eyesight, black is their rescuing color. Because right now, if I try to use sign language against the white background here, you're going to have trouble reading my sign language if you're losing your eyesight. If Karen, however, Karen, please raise your hand for me if you would. If you try to do sign language with Karen's hand, and you can see Karen, yeah, Karen in Vietnam versus Karen in Louisiana. You know, if you raise your hand, that's a good contrast. Hand against a white, well, that's interesting. A darker hand against a white light, I can see. Okay, Karen Gay. White hand against the black ground, I can see. Brent's pale beige hand against a beige background, you're not going to read my sign language. You're not going to be able to see what's going on. So the answer to your question is, ask, is black a good color for you, or is it a negative color? Gray, the most common color for repairing boundary damage, or trauma is a boundary violation. I'll let them tell me. We'll do all together at once. What is the main color for sexual abuse and people are repairing their sexual boundaries? What is their favorite gray color for repairing their sexual abuse boundaries?
Silver, pewter.
Pewter, thank you, A. Pewter. Pewter, Middle Ages, knight in armor. You become the knight in armor when you're recovering. They'll say, I see gray. Is that a good color? I didn't see it because I thought it was a bad color. I'm like, oh, no. Gray is the number one color that sexual abuse survivors use to repair their boundaries and put their boundaries back. Pewter gray, medieval, it's Jungian archetypal, repair your boundaries, we're not in the dark ages, you know, put the pewter gray back in your boundary. Black, calm, elegant, absolute. Some people, they only were safe at night when everybody was asleep. Black is their safe color. When it's nighttime, we can sleep. The crazy people have stopped. They all go to bed at night. So black can be your safe color. Here's the thing. Now, what you're remembering is when I said that in Egypt from archaeology, Remember we said the metallic whites mirror white light. Remember that? What were the first mirrors ever invented? What were the first mirrors in archaeology and human history? What were the first mirrors ever invented?
Obsidian.
Obsidian?
That's right. Polished obsidian from Egypt and some of the ancient cultures. If you polish a black stone and look into the face of it, what do you see? You see yourself. So black mirrors, they could see their reflection mirrored back from the sunlight. So what you're remembering that I talked about was that some blacks are actually forms of white light. So yes, you're remembering a piece of that correctly. That is right. So what happens is if you hold up an obsidian mirror, so you can say, is it a shiny black? Somebody say, is it a shiny black? Yeah, well, it's actually, you're using it like ebony or ebony wood. Are you using like, so a shiny black or any, even matte black can be positive. People love Art Deco. You're like, it's black and white. I'm an Art Deco crazy person. You know, I love Art Deco. So am I picking, you know, so black, white, and silver are their favorite colors. So every single color that exists can be positive or negative. You know, yellow can be nervous system, happiness, joy. I had a client today, yellow showed up and it's pus and infection. Yeah, I know, of course. So every color can be positive or negative. Green can be the color that heals physical trauma and ailment. Green is also gangrene. Like, yuck, okay. You know, so every color can have a positive or negative value. If, however, the colors that are being seen, like you can have polished metals, every metal color, you can have red metal, orange, green, blue, indigo, violet, white metals. If you polish them, they become like a mirror and they're reflectant red, orange. Copper is a reflectant orange. So these are colors that mirror, amplify, or reflect white light. And so, yes, black can be among those as well. You just have to ask. Now, sometimes if black is coming up, it's because there's, oh, he was white, now it's going black. There's another memory coming up, and you can ask, is there another memory surfacing at this point? But every color can be positive or negative. And does that help?
Yes, that's, I must have heard that from one of the other systems that I've studied that dealt with color. It probably wasn't you, but yeah, that helps
But if you hold up white light to a polished piece of black obsidian, you get a reflectance, which means it's a mirror, which puts it into the black obsidian is a form of white light. It's mirroring or amplifying white light. Anything that mirrors or amplifies color is mirroring it back at you. It's sending light into your nerve centers and into your eyes and so on, your receptors, your chromoreceptors. And so black then becomes a form of white light. So yes, I did say that in some of my books, I think the Healing Dimensions book, I talked about black as obsidian, that our first mirrors in Egypt and culture mirrored or amplified white light. The ideal force field around a person, I have some people say, oh, I have people reframe and say, what color sphere? What color is your energy field? Oh, it's black. They can't see me. I'm invisible. Nobody can harm me if I'm black. I'm like, okay, that's protective for you. That's okay. But polished obsidian, if it's a black sheen egg obsidian, it mirrors white light. It's a form of white. She's using it as a form of white light. So you'll just ask about context. Is the black that she's seeing a metaphor for trauma? Or is the black a solution phase and is a positive color? Okay. Anything else about color?
Yep. That's helpful. Thank you.
Cool. You're welcome. My pleasure. All right, folks. I guess we're done for now. We will see you next month. I will be speaking to you, I think, next month from Hawaii. Yep. So we'll be doing it from Maui. We got trainings going on. Yeah. So Ray and Judy got a group, Karen, 15 together. For Maui, so we're doing a training in Maui, and we'll probably start hopefully do regular trainings in Maui. That would be nice. Maybe we should move our retreats to Maui. What do you think about that idea? Anyway,
that would be great. That's a good idea. Do it.
Yeah, so we'll do that. We'll see. We'll pick different locations probably. We'll move.
I can't drive the truck to Hawaii.
We will fly you in the truck to Hawaii. How's that? If you want. You won't need to move the truck in Hawaii. You'll just bring yourself and a coconut to hold your Mai Tai, you know, when you go. That's all you'll need.
Okay.
Not for the Mai Tai. You'll get queenly treatment in Maui after all your hard work. See?
Oh, you're so sweet.
Well, we got to keep you operational, so yeah. No lifting heavy things. No lifting huge things anymore. We're gonna. It's time. The universe is protecting you, Jeanette. See, we're keeping you safe.
That's only for a couple of weeks. That's not permanent.
I know you're going to go try to pick up the LSU stadium and just,
Be nice. Be nice. There are still people on the, and we're recording, so be nice.
I know, but you're going to heal the whole planet. You got hundreds of little doggies coming in, and you got people coming in, and they're like, Jeanette, you might want to lighten your burden a little bit, And so accepting help and not having
You have other things that you wanted to talk about?
Trucks full of dishes. This is today we're talking about Jeanette's self-care, and that's our
I don't remember that on the agenda. That word nowhere on the agenda.
I added it as an extra special item about self-care. That if we're gonna be doing things tomorrow, we want all of our parts working, and you'll probably need your back at some point in time to do HMR. So anyway, it's all good. It's all part of a bigger plan. So thank you, Jeanette. Thank you for your hard work, all that's going on there. And so, yes, we are thinking about a gathering this time instead of our March retreat. Those of you listening, we're thinking about gathering in Houston or environs. Actually, I have to find out the HMR person I trained in Houston, Jeanette, because she was supposed to be opening a retreat center north of Houston and wanted me to do workshops at a retreat center north of Houston.
Okay.
And Karen Restivo. I just remembered her name. There you go. Karen Restivo. So look up Karen Restivo around Houston. I think she and her husband, and they were going to John of God in Brazil. Karen and her husband were traveling to see John of God in Brazil, which is now kaput. So we need to see if, because Gail channeled to Karen information about opening a retreat center north of Houston on the lake there. And I don't know if she did or not. But she's like, I'd love to have you. And she talked to me about, I'd love to have you come out and do retreats at my retreat center north of Houston. So I will try to track her down, and maybe you try to track her down. And she was a social worker, Karen Restivo, and maybe that might be something that will work out. So we'll all keep investigating. All right, apart from that, thanks everybody. I have to go to dinner in about 15 minutes. So have fun, let's stay in touch. And keep cool.
Next month.
Okay, next month?
Yep.
Keep practicing. Keep those colors flowing.
I will.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Talk to you later.